about their work to build ASI's unified African economy. And then in the second hour of Africa Live, Chairman O'Malley will talk about, he's going to be interviewing Abdul Ali, who is a victim of U.S. secret prisons. Ali is a named party in a current lawsuit against Attorney General Eric Holder. He talks about the living conditions in the communications management units at Marion and Terre Haute, including the life-threatening denial of medical care, constant threats and violence by ex-soldier guards, open sewage, toxic flooding, and denial of family contact visits in the formerly condemned death row building. It's a really powerful interview, so stay tuned for Africa Live.
Everybody feel high, but if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now when you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah. Get up, stand up,
jump, jump.
Stand up for your rights.
Africa Live.
Brothers and sisters, comrades, welcome to Africa Live. I'm O'Malley Shatella, hosting today's show. I want to say that we are very fortunate to have in the studio with us today comrades Ona Zene Ishatella, who is the deputy chair of the African People's Socialist Party, functioning currently. Also as the Director of Economic Development and Finance, and Marcus Kothner, who is the Assistant Director, Director of Economic Development and Finance for the African Socialist International. I want to welcome you again to this show. I think it's an important show. We want to talk about the economic program of the African People's Socialist Party that's characterized or currently consolidated in the work of the Black Star Industries primarily. It's an important discussion because for most of our movement, unfortunately, we do not see serious work being done around the question of economic development. And I think that one of the reasons that is the case has to do with the political line of the various organizations. For example, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, as it is known, does not have any kind of economic program that it is responsible for developing and carrying out itself. But that makes sense because the philosophy, the political line of the NAACP makes the assumption that African people within the United States will find our freedom from not from developing our own capacity as much as it is through integrating into the American system itself, integrating into the capitalist system. So it's not necessary for Africans ourselves to develop anything except our capacity to enter into the economic relations and economic institutions that's been created by somebody else. So it makes sense that they would not have economic institutions that they're working for. However, there are also other organizations that consider themselves nationalist or involved in struggle for political independence that have never made serious efforts to create economic institutions as well. And of course, this is quite different from the examples set by Marcus Garvey, who organized in the first part of the 20th century a magnificent organization up to 7 to 11 million members and supporters strong throughout the world, and that was characterized essentially through much of the economic work that the Garvey movement did. One institution, Black Star Lines, from which Black Star Industry takes its name, was designed for the purpose of facilitating trade between African people throughout the world. And even today, in 2012, we are faced with a situation that the Garvey movement presented probably the most cogent, comprehensive economic development, not just plan, but program that we have ever experienced as a people subsequent to having been enslaved in Africa, been captured and held under colonial domination. And of course, that makes sense because Garvey's movement was a movement about the liberation of the African nation, the unification and liberation of the African nation. And for any nation, it is absolutely necessary to have an economic life. An economic life will either be one that is dependent on some external force, or it will be dependent on a people's own capacity to produce whatever it is necessary for our ability to actually create and recreate life. Unfortunately, for most of the African world, part of what characterizes our current situation is that although we engage in production, it is production that facilitates the creation of life for somebody else. And that has been true since Africa was captured and since we were captured from Africa. This is the origin of the parasitic social system that we know as capitalism, which came out of our capture and the capture of Africa itself. So, like Garvey, because we are intent on the liberation of African people, we are also intent on creating a free African economy, not dependent, not tied to a parasitic relationship to someone else that means that what we produce does not go, does not contribute to the development and well-being of the African nation. Black Star Industries is a fundamental effort being made by the party to take this question on. Now, our movement, as well as most of the organizations throughout the African world, we've always suffered from a lack of resources, and this lack of resources is something that reflects the actual economic situation with African people in general. And we've always done the typical things. We've done the car washes, we've done the dinner sales and things of this sort, but obviously this is not enough. A nation to be free has to have the ability to feed, clothe, and shelter itself. Beyond that, the question that we are always confronted with is, once independent, what kind of social system are we talking about? We've seen throughout the African world and throughout the world at large where there have been people once suppressed and once dominated as nations who finally win their independence only to find themselves trapped, the masses trapped with a social system that does not represent their interest and does not contribute to the development of the masses of our people. So we are concerned not only with having an economic development, but also what kind of social system will we have? Will we have a social system based on the capitalism that captured and enslaved us and even now holds the world under domination of exploitation, where what we produce does not go to benefit ourselves and our community? Or will we have a social system where the masses of people who produce all the value have the ability to own and control the value that is produced? These are fundamental questions that we've had to grapple with, and I'm sure you, our listeners, would be interested in understanding how we deal with this question as well. We believe that it is necessary to create an African national economy, a free economy, and that it is the responsibility of the revolution to do this, that it is not something that is done or should be considered only after some kind of achievement of revolution, but the political work to make the revolution should include the economic work. That political, when we look at the conditions of African people, talking about the economy, we're talking about a political contradiction. We're talking about a political contradiction being responsible for African people not being able to realize our needs in terms of having a free economy. So to talk with us on today, Ona Zene Ishitela and Marcus Kaufner, and we're going to talk about Black Star Industries and how Black Star Industries takes on the question about developing our own free economy, an international economy, and how Black Star Industries begins to deal with the question of what kind of economic system we're going to have, what kind of social system we're going to have, and how it is developing certain kinds of subsidiary relationships with individuals and other groups, and how it is open to developing relationships with individuals and groups. So I want to welcome you, Ona Zene Ishitela and Marcus Kaufner. Uhuru. Well, I've just done a pretty long and, I guess, rambling intro to what it is that we want to talk about, and the length of the introduction, I think, responds to the kind of newness to what it is that we're taking on, and we want to introduce this to the people in a way that it is understood differently from, again, just doing the car washes that we typically do, and obviously we want people in the movement to do whatever it is necessary to generate the kind of resources that will contribute to our being a self-reliant organization. But we have to move beyond that. This is something that we've understood for a long time and that Garvey was the example of. And so with Black Star Industries, it seems to me that we've taken a major leap in constructing a capacity to begin really developing the infrastructure and the real economic capacity for the African nation. So I don't know if either of you is prepared at all to tell us, you know, can you tell us about Black Star Industries? What, Ona Zene Ishitela, is Black Star Industries, and what is it that, how is it that you think it will be moving forward in the immediate future?
Well, Chairman, I just really want to thank you for the introduction. Black Star Industries is a limited liability company that brings all the economic development institution of the African People's Socialist Party under one single umbrella. And we also are in the process of developing subsidiary partnerships with enterprising individuals out in the world that have ideas and business ideas that they want to bring and develop on their own. So it's a two-four. It's one, as a party liability company, and it's also open to enterprising individuals who want to take on ownership of their own business.
But Black Star Industries already does own various institutions that are functioning. Can you say anything about that at all?
Yes, right now we have about six functioning subsidiaries that the African People's Socialist Party own under Black Star Industries. And one is the one that we're recording on right now is Uhura Radio. It's one of the 100% owned subsidiaries. We also have Uhura Publication, Uhura Foods and Pies, which has been around for more than 30 years now. We also have Uhura, the One Market, African Marketplaces in Philadelphia and in Houston, and which we'll be developing here in St. Petersburg, Florida, coming soon. And we also have the apparel line of Uhura Planet that we have under Black Star Industries as well.
And you characterize them as 100% owned.
100% ownership. Because, like I was saying earlier, the business partnerships is up to 51% owned by Black Star Industries and 49% owned by other enterprising individuals.
So, Marcus, can you tell us anything at all about some of the things that are in the pipeline? One is Ine Shatella was telling us about the existing 100% owned entities of Black Star Industries, and she suggested that there are other kinds of entities that Black Star Industries will be owning or will be participating in partnering with. Can you say something about any of those entities as that are being developed at all?
Yes, Uhuru. So far we have Bantu Enterprise, which is a clothing line, which is now in the UK, and which already started to work. And we have Uhuru Arts, which is based in Belgium, which is a kind of platform for African artists to present and to sell their arts and goods, and to give the opportunity to them as well to present it. Because we know when we talk about African arts, we mostly see them on markets or in Africa selling their stuff underpriced, and Uhuru Arts is a platform for them to sell their goods on a professional manner and for the right price. Yeah, these are the two right now that we have on the Black Star Industries.
That's good. And the thing is that it's mentioned that the entities that are not 100% owned by Black Star Industries, or by, I should say, not by Black Star Industries, by Black Star Industries, the corporations or companies that will be, I've heard them referred to as kind of partnerships, and Bantu is one of them, and Uhuru Arts is another of them. And I think one of the things that makes this significant is that we are also looking at the kind of economics that we are trying to promote for the development of an African economy. Clearly, we don't have an African economy. That doesn't exist anywhere in the world. And I would quickly make the statement to people who might be jumping to criticize us for assuming that we can build an economy step by step in the way that we are trying to do within the African Socialist International, African People's Socialist Party, that there is no political economy. Africa does not own and have an economy. So that's the that's independent. That's a free economy. That's our own. And that's the thing that we are struggling to create. But in the places that pretend to have economies, most instances, these are economies that are tied in bed in the most serious way with imperialism, imperialist corporations, etc., and they're capitalist-based economies. And when we say capitalist-based economies, we mean that primarily they are economic entities that benefit from the exploitation of the labor and resources taken from African people without a meaningful payment for the value of the resources and of the labor. And now what we're talking about with Black Star Industries is it is socialistic in the sense that while it is not socialism as such, because we do live in a capitalist world economy, and that we are in the process of trying to win our freedom in this process, the fact is that with the Black Star Industries, with the party functioning in many ways as a state would function, you have a situation where the 100% entities are owned by the people, and then the other entities that we are talking about, the so-called partnerships, where individuals and or groups can come together and own up to 49%. This then is a situation where the people still own the majority. The people own the majority, that is the people in the aggregate, in the form of the party, while individuals and groups from among the people have an incentive to become part of this enterprise, and they can develop, you know, resources for themselves, even for the group of them. And so, while it's not you know, absolutely like socialist, it is socialistic. It moves toward socialism, and where the majority ownership is in the hands of the people as opposed to individuals, and that it's an entity not based on exploiting the labor of other folk primarily, but benefiting the people through the relationship that the party has to the revolutionary process. So I just think that's really, you know, like an important thing for us to understand and to acknowledge, and for the people, you know, who are listening to understand, because as I understand it, almost anybody can become a part of Black Star Industries. Can either of you talk at all about that?
Well, Chairman, before I talk about that, I just want to make a comment about what you were just referring to. Like, for instance, Bantu Enterprises, they developed this red, black, and green scarves that were going to be sold throughout, you know, the world. And what happened was that they were getting the scarves from China, and which is a problem, you know, for us as one African people. We wanted to, like, build commerce within our own economic world. So what we decided to do was we wanted to partner with APDEP, which is another institution that is affiliated with the African People's Socialist Party in Sierra Leone. We have a Sierra Leone APDEP in Sierra Leone. So we wanted to get with the vocational school there and have them develop the scarves there, so we can keep commerce, you know, going within the African economy, you know, because if we buy from China, we're just like everybody else, you know. So we want to, you know, keep our resources within, you know, the African economy. So we're really looking for companies that, you know, want to be a part of Black Star Industries and want to stay within, you know, this particular institution.
Well, you're talking about APDEP, that's the All African People's Economic Development Empowerment Project, and which, as you say, is affiliated with the party, the Uhuru Movement, and is doing a lot of work in West Africa, particularly in Sierra Leone, where some institutions, it has a vocational school where I think primarily women who are participating in this school also create various kinds of artifacts and for sale in order to support the school and themselves. And so now with this relationship with Black Star Industries, the expectation is that the scarves that are coming from Bantu, that does its own apparel line, can now come from Sierra Leone, and it begins the development of a kind of comprehensive international economy functioning within the African nation. And I think that's positive. That's exactly what it is that we're talking about and what we want people to be able to understand, that, that this is not a little thing that we're doing, and the objective is to, even as right now, we have small enterprises that's associated with it. The objective is to actually develop an industrial capacity that a nation has to have, and that these, this is the way forward. And I think that's what's really important is, I remember after the Cuban Revolution, they ran into this real problem of the revolutionaries not knowing anything about how to run businesses. You know, they know how to make revolution, but they didn't know how to run businesses, and therefore they had this problem of having to go back to the same petty bourgeoisie that worked for imperialism to try to make the economy work. And in fact, Che Guevara ended up playing a real important role in trying to play an important role, because he was a leading revolutionary in working in the Cuban economy. And what we are doing now, it seems to me, is with starting from the bottom up, that as revolutionaries taking on this work, and it's been difficult because we are not economists as such, even though we are beginning to win more and more people like that into the process, but we're starting from the bottom up. We engaged in the economic work as a part of the political work that's necessary to for a free nation to exist. And so I am impressed by this process as it is unfolding. I know that there's a lot that we are still, you know, learning and having to learn in order to move the project forward. So we have, you mentioned Hoota Radio, mm-hmm. Burning Spear Newspaper is another entity that's owned by Black Star Industries. Uhuru, go ahead.
Burning Spear Publication, which is the publication that of your writings, Penny Hess, chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, mm-hmm. and we're beginning to take on other theoretical writers within the Uhuru movement as far as publishing books and pamphlets and their writings as well.
Right.
We have the Uhuru Flea Markets right now that is located in Philadelphia. We also have in Houston as well, and we're getting ready to develop the Uhuru Flea Market here in St. Petersburg, Florida. We also have a Uhuru Planet, which house all of our T-shirts, you know, for the movement. And we're really getting ready to expand that with hats, scarves, and other merchandise that we're trying to develop as well.
You're now listening to Africa Live on Uhuru Radio. We have the pleasure of being involved in discussion with comrades Marcus Kaufner, who is the Assistant Director of Economic Development and Finance of the African People's Socialist Party, and with Ona Zene Shatella, who is the Director of Economic Development and Finance for the African People's Socialist Party. I'm Omali Shatella, your host. We're going to take a brief momentarily and be right back with you to continue this very important discussion.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Tired of too many reruns on Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
Uhuru brothers and sisters, comrades, we're back. This is Africa Live. I'm Omali Shatella, who is hosting the show on today and have this splendid opportunity to discuss with Unazene Ishitela and Marcus Kaufman, who tied to the Office of Economic Development and Finance of the African People's Socialist Party, the African Socialist International. And we've been discussing Black Star Industries, which is an economic venture, more or less, that's designed to really work on building the political free economy, if you will, of the African nation itself. I should mention that the Black Star Industries is a limited liability company that is licensed to function within the United States, and also, I've just learned, we're licensed to function in Europe as well. Primarily, we are licensed in England, but our work is happening in various parts of Europe. I wanted to say that the Black Star Industries is not just a small thing. It's truly a reflection of our ideology. I mentioned earlier the example of the NAACP, and there are other organizations that, while claiming to be for the emancipation of African people on the one hand, don't take on this most fundamental area of work, which is the development of the economy that is necessary for any free people. There's no free people on earth that does not have a free economy. That's not to say that economies and economic activity is not interchanged with other countries and other economies, but if a people is not in control of his own economy, then it is not a free people. At best, it's a colonial, a colonized population. At worst, it's an enslaved, absolutely enslaved population. I remember that from time to time, we engage in certain kinds of debates and struggles within what is supposed to be the African Liberation Movement, particularly in the United States. And people often reference the fact that there are the economic institutions, and I think we should say something about these institutions that directly or indirectly tied to Black Star Industries, certainly to the economic activity of the African People's Socialist Party. They see these institutions, they experience them because they are real and in the world on the one hand, and they talk about what the great fact is that we have these institutions and what these institutions could mean, but they talk about this as though it is something that is separate from who we are, that we are the African People's Socialist Party, and we created these institutions not just because we thought it would look good to have institutions, but because it reflects our ideology, it reflects our worldview that requires African people to be free and to be independent, and we cannot do that without an economy. And the fact is that we are struggling now and preparing to govern, and to govern a free and independent people requires a free and independent economy, a political economy. And that is how we view the work that we're doing with Black Star Industries. It is not casual activity. It is not something that we're doing because we just want somebody to have a job or somebody to have something to do. Although creating employment is critical for our existence on the one hand, but the most critical thing is to have a free economy, because under slavery there was full employment, and just being employed is not enough. A people has to have control of its own economy, otherwise we will simply continue to be beggars, even though we are people, you know, who possessed in terms of natural and even human materials incredible kind of wealth. We don't benefit from that. So this is what Black Star Industries is about taking on. We just mentioned Bantu. Marcus, you were working seriously with Bantu, right? How is it? Bantu, what is the full name of it?
It's Bantu Enterprise.
Bantu Enterprise,
yes.
Which is becoming part of a subsidiary of Black Star Industries.
Yes, which Bantu Enterprise actually has applied and has been accepted as a subsidiary for BSI.
So there's an application process, yeah, that's involved.
Yes, there's an application process that's involved, and I mean, you need to lay down what your plan is, where you want to go, and why you would like to be a part of Black Star Industries. It's really a scientific approach that you need to have on the application. It's not just you calling somebody and saying, no, I want to be part of BSI. So.
Right. I just want to say about the application process, it is an extensive application process because, you know, as being a limited liability corporation, we want to make sure that we get the best information we can in order to help facilitate the person who's applying to Black Star Industry come in and have the best opportunity to succeed. So we do require a business plan. We do require a budget. We do require the normal things that you would do have to complete in a normal process in order to start your business, because this is the only way we can know exactly what we need to do to help you succeed in making this a success. So the application process is pretty extensive.
But the problem is that most instances, the processes that you've just mentioned, the business plan, the budget, all of this is too often used as stumbling blocks to keep Africans from being able to get their business or to get the business loan or to get the what they need in order to start a business.
And yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the areas that we're actually asking people to help facilitate us with. If you have those skills where you've been in banking and accounting and whatever, we're looking for volunteers to come in and help us review these applications and help us move forward helping the individual become successful. So it's not a stumbling block for us. We want to help facilitate them to get through the application process.
So if we have just ordinary people who may have great ideas, but they can't move forward because they don't know how to do business plans, because they don't know how to create budgets and things like that, are you saying then that Black Star Industries will facilitate their ability to do that? So this ignorance, which is temporary and can be cured, is something that will not stop them, should not stop them from being successful with what is an otherwise good plan, in terms of some kind of economic enterprise.
Absolutely. You know, we're here to help. We're not here to stop people from seeing their future go down the drain because they can't fill out an application or don't have access to being able to develop a budget. You know, we're here to help facilitate all the needs of the application process and beyond that as well.
Well, beyond that is the fact that we're not just talking about helping an individual, because the more Africans who have some kind of capacity that we can bring into this process and under the general umbrella of Black Star Industries, the more we are involved in the actual liberation of an African national economy that will be able to take care of our own needs as a people, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So, Marcus, you're going to tell us, though, about Bantu Enterprises. What does Bantu mean, anyway?
Bantu comes... it means actually people that use their head. I mean, you may hear Bantu in referred to as a ethnicity or something like this, but it actually means somebody who uses his head. And the name was chosen wisely because it is something. Bantu is an enterprise where you have people starting to use their head.
And the language, where is the language?
The language, it's Kikongo, which is coming from the Congo Basin, Congo area.
Okay.
And yeah, that's Bantu. And Bantu is creating clothes, and Bantu is trying to create revolutionary clothes with slogans that are for the consciousness of the people, and not only try to get rich or die or stuff like this. It's really something that tries to educate in one go and tries to clothe you in a modern way. Yeah.
Well, I have one of the jackets, and when I travel throughout Europe, there's certainly where a movement is involved. I mean, I see everybody wearing, and not only in the movement, because I think they're stylish and what have you, and so it's something that obviously young people gravitate toward, and I think it's an exciting enterprise. And I anticipated having a real future. So, do we have any idea of when Bantu will become fully like a part of BSI?
We're working on it right now. We're working on it because what we have now is we're trying to gain some experience because, Bantu has no experience actually. It started as from zero, from scratch, and there are a lot of things that we have to learn in order to say, okay, now we are fully functional. For example, Bantu still needs a website and some help in marketing and stuff like that. But we hope that we get at least mid-2013 with the ALD in Paris 2013 that we can really launch a bright line of clothing, and not only the jackets or a couple of t-shirts, but really a big line of clothing.
I've learned recently that there's I think something called streetwear, and that is pretty, is even though it's a lot of young people wear the attire, it's kind of exclusive in the sense that they don't make a lot of the same products, and they're relatively expensive, but they can be seen almost everywhere. And I just think that what I find really interesting is recently on a tour, I was in England, Sweden, Germany, and Belgium, and in all of those places, so-called countries, people are wearing Bantu Enterprise clothing, and I think that's magnificent. I mean, even in the process of developing and building the company, in all these countries, not only are people wearing them, but people recognize them. They become popular, and people recognize the movement because people are wearing because they're wearing these kinds of clothing. So I just think it's really promising what we are looking at.
One of the things I do like too about Bantu Enterprises is that the t-shirts that they design are also t-shirts that fits women. I have a real big problem with buying t-shirts, all the time that are made for men.
Right.
But they actually cater to the needs of women, their body type. So I really appreciate that about Bantu Enterprises.
Well, this is Africa Live. I'm Amale Shatella. We discussing Black Star Industries on today with Ona Ishitella, who is the director of the Office of Economic Development and Finance of the African People's Socialist Party, and the assistant director Marcus Kofner is participating in this discussion as well. And I have to tell you, I know it's late in the day to tell you that this is a pre-recorded a session, so I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of interest in discussing things with these comrades, but we won't be able to do it on today on this show because the call-in will not be effective. As I said, it is a recorded show, but people who want to get in touch can do that by, can you give that information?
You can call 1-866-596-1921. That's 1-866-596-1921.
That's the U.S. number.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You can email us at information@bsi1billionstrong.com. That's information@bsi1billionstrong.com. And you can visit our website at www.bsi1billionstrong.com.
1 billion strong. What's that about?
Africans 1 billion strong. Marcus Garvey.
Mm. Okay. Well, back in the day of Garvey, Garvey used to talk about 400 million Africans around the world. And today, we are something like 1.5 billion Africans around the world. So I like the concept because it helps Africans to understand that we're not a minority wherever we are, especially when we recognize that we are one people. I would like now, if you would, We've talked about some of the institutions that's owned by Black Star Industries, and then of course there are other institutions that are affiliated with Black Star Industries that I think it's important for people to know that we're talking about real concrete entities that do exist, that do function in the world, that you can go different places and you can see them, not just on the internet, but there are actual locations, actual entities that work right now. And I'm wondering if either of you or both of you could talk at all about these institutions.
Well, one of the institutions that we have right now that exists in Philadelphia is the One Nation, One Africa, One Nation Marketplaces. In Philadelphia, we recently, last month, had a health fair there that brought thousands of people in to talk about the conditions of health and the health disparities of Africans, not just in Philadelphia, but all over the world. We also have this, where we're broadcasting right now, Uhuru Radio.
Can you say more about the Uhuru, the marketplace, just in terms of, to give people an idea of, you know, like, how is it an economic entity? And I think it's great that we do the work that you talked about in terms of the health fair, but how is it an economic entity?
Well, one of the things that we do is it's fully owned by us. It's fully ran by us. So we have anywhere from 90 to 110 vendors that come out every weekend to participate in vending. So we're helping to build, you know, not only economic commerce through that process, but we're also creating jobs and for individuals and families. So we have, like I said, anywhere from 110 vendors that come out, anywhere from selling, you know, earrings, clothing, health products, food, anything that you can think of that a market holds, that flea market is there and developed through that process.
So in addition, though, through people being able to vend on the spot, mm-hmm. and then, of course, people from the community and from other communities coming to purchase, and I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have the flea market functions as a kind of incubator so that groups that might not have much money, but they can start off, mm-hmm. they can get experience, mm-hmm. you know, selling and mm-hmm. marketing their goods and things like that. And then they may even end up in a storefront,
right.
you know, start beginning
right.
to move bigger that. So you have this incubating possibility with that, and I
right.
think that's good, yeah.
Yes, and that institution actually has been around for the last 10 years in Philadelphia.
All right.
And right now we're really looking to use that as a template here in Florida so we can also make it happen here as well.
You were looking at something like that for the Bahamas too, weren't you, in Nassau?
Yes, we were, yes.
Okay. You were going to say something about Uhuru Radio, I think.
Uhuru Radio, where we're broadcasting from right now, has been around for a very long time. How many years, Chairman?
I don't know, it's been, something like 6 years.
6 years. Mm-hmm. So this is another wholly owned subsidiary of Black Star Industries. And right now, we're really in the process of developing Uhuru Radio as one of the major internet radio shows, you know, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking for people who are interested in helping to build the radio station, to come in and bring in your expertise, you know, and help develop us more widely.
Mm-hmm. Any other institutions you want to talk about? What is Uhuru Foods and Pies?
Uhuru Foods and Pies actually has been around for more than 30 years. We bake pies every year, starting actually for Thanksgiving, and we also bake pies and for Christmas. But right now we are in the development under a nonprofit that is also affiliated with Black Star Industries called African People's Education and Defense Fund. We're in the process of developing GECO kitchens, and I'm proud to say that our kitchen in St. Petersburg, Florida, opened just this past Monday for the first time. We've been trying to raise money to help develop that. Now we've gotten the resources, and now we're baking in our kitchen for the first time in 30 years. So I'm really happy to say that.
Okay. You mean it's a commercial, licensed commercial kitchen?
It's a licensed commercial kitchen where people from the community can come in, and if you have products that you want to develop in your kitchen and you need a place, a licensed place to develop that, we have that in the form of Chico Uhura Kitchen.
And that's one in St. Petersburg, and there's another that's being developed?
This one is in St. Petersburg, but we also have one that's going to be developed in 2013 in Oakland, California.
Hmm. Marcus, were you going to contribute anything to that?
No, I think that Ona already said everything.
I just want to say that we're not talking now. We've established the fact that there are certain, you said, I think, six economic entities. We didn't mention the fact that Uhuru Foods also does flea markets, but you know, various kinds of markets, mm-hmm. and what have you, that we sell our goods. We participate in markets in Florida and in Philadelphia and other places and all around the country, United States anyway, and that we're looking at being able to do that soon, certainly in England, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things about that, and we talked about some of the partially owned entities that some are in the pipeline, even as we have this discussion, like Bantu Enterprises. We didn't mention in any detail beyond, I think it was Uhuru Pies, we didn't mention in any detail the affiliates, the non-profit affiliates that are part of an overall kind of economic view that people should get of what we do. For example, there are furniture stores owned by mm-hmm. affiliates that are associated with this, and in Philadelphia and in Oakland, California, there's a gym that's owned by the same affiliate in St. Petersburg, Florida. There are various other kinds of institutions. I just think it's really important to know that we're talking about, you know, developing a really comprehensive economic approach and program, not just the regular kind of fundraising, but actually economic development that we want to consolidate for Africa and for African people. It is not open right now, I gather, for participation by everybody, or is it?
No. Right now it's only open to party members of the African People's Socialist Party, but we will be opening up this process August of 2013 after our national Congress in New Jersey. So it will be open after that to people from the outside to participate in completing their applications.
Why are you waiting?
Well, one of the reasons why we're waiting, we're trying to get out all the kinks that is associated with developing such a tremendous, this, like you were saying, this is no small task. And we want to make sure that we are ready to be able to sell applications and be fully staffed and ready to, you know, take this to the next level.
Splendid. But if people wanted to, they could support this effort in any number of ways, I imagine.
Right. People can volunteer. They can donate resources. Like I said earlier, we do need people that are either can teach how to do complete applications, also critique applications, people who know how to help others write business plans. So we do. We have other things that people can do to get involved.
And I meant money. I think money is going to be important, because unlike capitalism that started off with what they call primitive accumulation by selling black people, I don't think we have any plans to go out and sell anybody. So, but we do need money. We need startup capital. We need money for some of the existing projects. I know there's a lot of money that can be used here for Uhuru Radio, the plans that's there, and money for even for some of the partnerships that we're going to have.
Right.
You're talking about building a national economy. It would seem to me that the nation, Africans everywhere, would have some need to make contributions to give money and to give it as quickly and effectively as possible, especially especially during a time like this where the economic crisis is so severe. So how would people do that? If they wanted to send in money, if they wanted to send in a check right away, how would they get the money to us and for themselves?
Well, right now they can send a check to Black Star Industries, 1245 18th Avenue South, St. Petersburg, Florida. Zip code is 33705. Our telephone number is 1-866-596-1921. They can send an email to information at BSI1BillionStrong.com, or they can visit our website where we have a donation button that they can donate directly to Black Star Industries at www.BSI1BillionStrong.com.
Whoa. So, we only got a minute or two left. I'm wondering if there's anything else that you wanted to say. I really appreciate your participation in this. I think it's really important to take this question of economic development out of the closet. Even within our own movement, we put this question of economic development in a sort of ghetto where the whole movement does not necessarily appreciate the significance of economic work as political work. Economic work has sort of been that other kind of thing that we do. That's not even a pleasant thing for some people, but it's not been seen as political work because there's no free nation ever place, any place on earth without having a free economy. And I think this is a critical aspect of the work, and I think it's a statement of the maturity of our movement that we have made such an investment in the development of the economics activity, the economic development for Africa and African people. So is there anything else you want to say before in terms of closing us out?
Uhuru, I just want to welcome everybody to really go to our website and check out Black Star Industries and see how you can get involved, especially when we get ready to open up in August of 2013. We're really going to need everybody participation. If you have some time that you need to can volunteer, please, hit us up on the website or give us a call and we'll take your information and just get involved in helping us build this economic commerce for the African nation. Uhuru.
Yes, I just want to say the same thing. Get your papers ready, write your ideas down, and send us from August 2013 your ideas so, we can build that together. Uhuru.
Well, brothers and sisters, I want to thank you very much for your participation here. I think it's been a really important and productive discussion. Clearly, comrades Ona Zenea Shatella and Marcus Kaufner are quite serious about the work that they're involved in and helping to build this economic component of our revolutionary movement. I think that the activity that they're involved in is a statement, again, of the seriousness and maturity of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International itself. It is a work that is happening on various continents right now, not only within the United States, but as we've stated, there's work that's happening in the United Kingdom, in Belgium, and in West Africa, Sierra Leone, West Africa, and we expect to see that grow in those places and expand to other places as well. I want to thank you, and I want to thank everybody for coming to participate on today. And next week, same time, we'll be here with Africa Live. This is Omari Yeshatella. Uhuru.
You're listening to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com.
Tired of too many reruns on Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
Africa Live.
Brothers and sisters, welcome to Africa Live. I'm Omalia Shatella. I'm hosting this show. On today, we want to deal with a very, very serious matter. I have on the phone with me Brother Abdul Ali. Brother Abdul Ali is working with Imam Musa Abdul, who is the Imam of Masjid al-Islam, one of the mosques of the Masjid al-Islam is located in Washington, D.C. I happened to meet Brother Abdul Ali in Washington, D.C. on November 3rd at the Black is Back mobilization. That is to say, the mobilization of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations that participated in, organized a four Washington, D.C. Rally, march, and conference on the 4th of November entitled Break the Silence Against the Wars That's Being Made Against African People Around the World, including here in the United States. There's no doubt in the minds of most of us that there is a serious war that's happening against African people in the United States, and that the prison system, the mass incarceration, represents one front of this war. In the United States, where there is a prison population more than 2 million, the largest prison population in the world, where half of the prison population are Africans, where one out of every eight persons in the world locked up is an African in the United States. Clearly, the situation of Africans in prison has to be designated as a form of warfare being made against a colonized population. When I was in Washington, D.C. on November 3rd at the Black is Back Coalition, Brother Abdul Ali talked to me briefly to say that he was one of those persons who has been locked up in a near-secret prison system that exists here in the United States that ostensibly is designed to deal with special kinds of problem individuals, terrorists or near-terrorists or terrorist associates or something to that extent. This is a system that where there are at least two prisons that we are familiar with, and one of them is in Terre Haute. and Indiana. And this is where Brother Abdul Ali was held for a period of time. And we want to talk to him about that. We want to talk to him about what is the CMU, what is the Communications Management Unit, as these prisons are designated. What does it take for one to be determined worthy of imprisonment at a CMU, and what are the conditions being faced by prisoners under these circumstances? And I think, brothers and sisters and comrades, this is something that should give pause to all of us. We need to consider the meaning and significance of these secret and near-secret prisons that exist in this country that poses around the world as some kind of beacon for democracy, and in fact has engaged and does engage at this very moment in wars against people, ostensibly for the purpose of taking democracy to those countries. Brother Abdul, welcome.
Yes, how are you? Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, brother. I want to thank you for being with us. And you heard my introduction to this segment of the show that we're involved in. We were talking about this this communications management unit. I think that most people have never heard of this communications management unit, a kind of prison system within the prison system. Perhaps you can say something about that. What is the communications management unit?
Okay, the Communications Management Unit, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, is a unit that was designed and run to monitor the communication of inmates in the Federal Bureau of Prisons with their contact in the free society. Before we just go into the unit itself, it's something that really needs to be put on the table and out front for the public to know that these units were set up illegally. They have what's known as the Administrative Procedure Act for proposed rules. When the government want to institute a new rule, or they want to, you know, make a change in the way the federal government run things, they have to run that new rule in the Federal Register for public opinion and public comments, because, see, they work for us. They're not our masters. So they failed to run the new rule for the Communication Management Unit in the Federal Register. However, they set up a unit in December of 2006, and they called it the Communication Management Unit. And it's in what's known as the Old Death Row Unit in Terre Haute, Indiana. Bear in mind that the Death Row Unit was condemned as unfit for human habitation. So they just slid it in there and opened up this new unit. Now,
well, before you move forward, Brother Abdul, you said that they did not establish this CMU, or the Communications Management Union, properly. That
no, sir.
According to law, some regulation, federal regulations, they were supposed to announce this in a federal registry, and they failed to do that?
Yes, sir. The Administrative Procedure Act, it calls for certain things to come into play before government officials can actually enact laws on top of the public here in America, and they failed to follow those procedures.
So it appears that there was an intent all along for this to be a secret entity that the public would not know about.
Yes, sir.
Would you say that's
in secret?
Yeah, that's what it seems like. If they failed to register, that the intent all along was to keep it below the radar so that it would not be able to have public scrutiny.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you were saying they did this, and I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I thought that was a really important point that you made.
Yes, sir. Okay, now, the Bureau of Prisons, they instituted a new unit of cops in the U.S. prison called the Counterterrorist Unit. This unit is headed by one Les Smith. He's the chief of the Counterterrorist Unit. And the way they run that unit is that they have that unit wired for sound. That unit is wired for visual observation. And I'm talking about even when the inmates are in their cell, Les Smith and his cohorts at the Counterterrorist Unit, which is located right here in Washington, D.C., and there's another one in Virginia, I believe, you know, they monitor everything in the unit. Also, the referrals to be sent to that unit is sent to Les Smith. And this is something that's very important that I think we need to know also, that all inmates in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, when they get classified, they're classified on an Army base in Grand Prairie, Texas. And what is the Army doing classifying inmates? What is the Federal Bureau of Prisons doing with a classification unit for the prisoners on an Army base in Grand Prairie, Texas? Mm-hmm. That's something that we need to look at also. And
what does that imply to you, Brother Abdul?
That implies to me that the United States Army, that they're using the Bureau of Prisons to see how to run larger concentration camps here in the United States. Why else would they want to be involved in classification of inmates?
Okay.
Unless then they have something on their mind.
Okay. And the secret prison, what was going to be a secret prisons on top of that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, let's look at the fact that inside the unit itself, and this is the only prison itself that the FBI has an office right there inside the unit at Turret Hut. I'm talking about you have a FBI agent stationed right there inside the communication management unit. I don't know if there's one in Marion, but I definitely know that there's one in FCI Turret Hut. And his name is Agent Grass.
Grass?
Grass, yes, like the grass grow outside.
Okay.
And he has a henchman who is an intelligence officer named Terry Coleman. Now, these two guys here, they regulate the so-called security of the inside workings of the CMU. And you have, of course, you know, you have unit staff officers, and you have regular staff. But let's talk about some of the unit staff officers that work there. You know, majority of the officers in the Federal Bureau of Prisons are retired veterans. So you have officers that do or that have been stationed in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and they work in these units over top of Muslims that are so-called terrorists. And let's look at their mindset. If you were stationed in Iraq, in Afghanistan, how many of your friends did you see get killed by so-called Muslim militants? And they put these type of officers in the unit over top of so-called terrorist inmates in this communication management unit, which is designed for so-called terrorists.
But brothers and sisters, you're listening to Africa Live. I'm Amale Shatello, hosting this segment of the show. And on this segment, we are speaking with Abdul Ali, who is someone who spent a considerable amount of time in one of the secret or near-secret prisons in the United States, considered a communications management unit, this one located in Indiana in Terre Haute. Go ahead, Brother Abdul. You were telling us about the kind of personnel who is employed at this prison system. You can go ahead and talk about that, please.
Okay. Basically, you know, some of these officers and these staff members, let's talk about two of them in particular. Actually, three of them that I know by name. One of them is an officer by the name of Hackett, and he made it clear that he had been to Afghanistan and Iraq, and that he was a demolition expert. And one of his comments that was made in front of me is, yeah, y'all blow us up, but I make bombs and blow y'all up. And you have another one, his name is Officer Carr. According to him, he is an expert sharpshooter, and he has several kills to his credit in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he makes it clear that he does not like the Muslims, and that's how he feels. He make it known what his attitude was and how he felt. But let's look at something else. They say that the designation to the CMU is not punitive, so therefore you have no right to due process, meaning that you can be snatched up from the regular inmate prison population and sent straight to the CMU, and you have no due process. In fact, I myself requested a due process hearing after being transferred to the CMU, and I was told by the acting unit manager, Ms. Lynn Fortune, that I did not have a right to due process hearing.
Did you say that the CMU is something that's ostensibly designed to manage communications between prisoners who have been designated as terrorists or linked to terrorism in some fashion? Is that how that's been characterized?
Okay, that's the way they claim, but let's look at myself.
Well, that's
okay.
What I'm asking, because that's what they claim, but you did not go to prison. Yeah. You didn't. You went to prison off street crime. It was not like some political act or anything like that that took you into prison in the first place, right?
No, sir.
Then How did you get to be thrown into this communication management unit?
Okay, the way I'm looking at it is, okay, I was very active in the prison. I was the religious imam for probably about 15 years inside the prison. And also I had filed several lawsuits, you know. And you know how they classify you as a writ writer. You're a troublemaker. You're always filing on the administration. And one of the things that I had at issue is the good time credit for D.C. inmates. They're not giving D.C. inmates their good time credits, some of us that are under the old law, and they're keeping us in prison way beyond due past our release dates. And in fact, that case is in court right now. So in retaliation for that, I was picked up and labeled an international terrorist / terrorist from United States Penitentiary Hazleton back in, what was that? It was May. In fact, it was May of 07 that I was designated as a terrorist, international terrorist / terrorist, without any due process at all. They told me that I was engaged in recruiting and radicalization of other inmates, and they showed me no disciplinary report. They showed me no written reports of any kind. And they just stuck me in the communication management unit and told me I didn't have a right to a due process hearing.
And you were saying something about that early on, that the due process was denied. And what was the justification that they used for the denial of due process?
Well, they say that the designation to that unit is not punitive, meaning that it's not a punishment that they put you in that unit.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at the way the unit is structured, and, well, let me just go through a few things for you. Let's say, for example, when you'd be on the main yard, which is the general population, you have something like 300 minutes per phone call for phone calls a month. In the communication management unit, you get 115 minute phone call a week there. That's when I first went there. We got one 15-minute phone call a week. We had one four-hour visit a month, or either two-hour visits a month. We stayed locked in the unit 24/7, 365 days. And there's, well, we can say that there's no law library, there's no regular library, there's no hobby crafts, there's no recreation facilities where you can go out in the yard. Jobs, the education department, the Unicorps, you know, all of this is gone. And we have to look at it a little bit in order to really understand. Like, if we was in the general population and we was on the yard, you know, we could go out to, we could go to the law library and we could just hang out and just, you know how we do in the prison.
I do.
Also, we have regular libraries that were there where you could just go to the regular library and you could hang out. You had the hobby class where you can go in and learn how to make hobby crafts. You could paint, you could work with leather, and you could, you know, in fact, you could learn a trade that would give you a benefit in free society. Also, there's no recreation yard there. The jobs were very few. If you have 50 people or 60 people in the unit and you only have 10 jobs, you know, what's going to happen with the rest of the people? And as you know, when you be on the main yard, you have all types of programs. You have education programs, you have trade programs, you have drug programs, you have a lot of psychological programs. None of that was there in the CMU. Also, you had Unicorps on the main yard, you know, where a guy could go and work for Federal Prison Industry, but in the CMU there was no Unicorps. And this is the real stopper. When the unit was death row unit, men that were condemned to death, they allowed them to work in Unicorps. They set up a Unicorps inside the unit for them to have a Federal Prison Industry program in the unit for death row inmates. But for the guys in the CMU, the Communication Management Unit, there was no Unicorps. In fact, a guy in the ADX, which is the highest security federal prison inside the Federal Bureau of Prison, which is in Florence, Colorado, where Imam Jamil Al-Amin is being illegally held, even they get 35 hours a month on the phone. Well, no. 35 hours a month for visits.
Okay.
But in the CMU, we only had, 4 hours a month. In fact, the way they have it set up now, this is what they want to actually institute in the CMU. They want you to have one 15-minute phone call per week. They want you to have one-hour visit a month. They want you to have one letter, three pages, front and back, per month. Not per month, per week. That's, you can send one letter out, and somebody can send you one letter in. Three pages, front and back. No more, no less. Now, let's look at this 15-minute phone call they allow you. If, let's say I'm from, let's just say I speak Spanish and I don't speak English. I have to get somebody to monitor the phone before I can set up a phone call.
You mean a prison? You mean some prison official that Spanish speaking?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's the same thing if I speak Arabic. You know, that someone else has to be right there to monitor the phone call in order for me to make a phone call. And if one word is said other than English, the phone automatically cuts off. And that's the same thing for visits. You know, there's no contact.
So the reason for the person standing there to monitor the call is to make sure that all discussions are in English? Is that what it is?
Yes. Well, he doesn't stand there. He listens on another phone.
Right.
Yes,
so
they have another.
So an Arab language speaker and a Spanish language speaker, as examples, would have to conduct their discussions in English?
would have to conduct it in English, or they would not be able to make a phone call until the Bureau of Prisons had someone available to monitor that call.
Okay. And if they did, if they did it without having someone there, I'm trying to understand what you were saying about how the phone could be, discussions could be stopped if something other than English was used.
Okay, well, the way the phone system works is you have to go to the, you know, where the command center in the unit for the officer where they run the unit from. You have to go to that command center and let the officer know that my time is on the, is for the phone. That if you have a phone call at 10 o'clock, you have to go to the command center and say, it's 10 o'clock, I have a phone call. And the officer will turn the phone on for you right there at inside the command center. Then you make your phone call, and he has the ability, him and someone at the counterterrorist unit, also the FBI office in the unit, and also Terry Coleman's office, they have control to cut that phone on and off at random.
Hmm. So, brothers and sisters and comrades, this is Amalia Shatella. We are talking with Brother Abdul Ali, who's in Washington, D.C., speaking to us by phone. It's an extraordinarily important discussion we're having with this brother right now. We're talking about the Communications Management Unit, which is a secret or near-secret prison system that's established within the prison system of the United States itself, that houses people who have been designated by the Federal Bureau of Prisons or by the United States government or some arm as affiliated in some fashion or another with terrorism, and therefore must have their communications with each other and other people managed under serious scrutiny. Brother Abdul was telling us that in Terre Haute, where he was located as a prisoner for a while, that not only were there the regular prison authorities there, but it was something that was done with an FBI office in the prison system, in the prison itself, and that was done in concert with the U.S. Army, which is also significant. Go ahead, Brother Abdul. I think this is a really important discussion, and I would like for our listeners to get the full benefit. I would like to know, I think that in terms of the conditions in the prison itself, that is probably worth speaking about them. As I understand it, you are in relatively small cells with concrete beds built into the wall, and I think I saw a complaint indicating that there was some kind of slime that was always coming down the walls onto the beds, etc. Can you say anything about the conditions in the prison?
Yes, sir, I will. Let's first look back in the history a little bit as to how so-called radical inmates were treated, or how inmates that were treated who wanted to concertize other inmates. One of the things that they would do is that they would throw you in what was known as a dry cell. That's a cell with nothing in it, no toilet, no sink, no bed, no nothing. They would throw you in there, and they would cut the water hose on and hose you down, and then cut the air conditioner on and try to freeze you or give you the pneumonia. Okay, since those tactics had been exposed and they could no longer do that, it was our belief, and I stayed there in the CMU, I was there for a little more than 39 months, that they drill holes in the roof on us. And when it would rain, if you check the history of the weather for like 2007, 2008, you'll see that it was a very heavy rain season. And when it would rain, the roof would leak. Now, up there in that roof, you have all kind of dust and soot and dirt. And once mixed with that water, it would drain right on down and run into the cells on us. Now, what that set does is it makes a black slime that would run down the wall. Now, the dead is a slab of, in fact, it is nothing but cinder blocks with a slab of concrete on top of it that's connected to the wall. So if that water is running down the wall, what happens? If you leave your mattress on the bed, the mattress is going to get wet. They're not going to give you another one. That slime, if you get on the linen, it's going to create a serious smell, and you'll be stuck in there with it until the rain stops. Now, myself, I was on the top tier, and when it would rain, the flood would be so bad that I would be standing sometimes ankle deep in the water. The guys on the bottom floor, the water would be well over their ankles because the water would run off of the top floor. And I'm not talking about a little bit of water. I'm talking about the water would come down in the cell like it was running out of the faucet sometimes, especially if it would rain real hard. In fact, we had to sit in the cell for 3 days because the unit flooded one time. And they just kept us in there on that water. The top tier guys could get the water off of the top tier, but the guys on the bottom tier would be stuck with the water in their cells. So we stayed in the water for like 3 days one time. The weekend, it rained real heavy one Friday, and we didn't get back out until that Monday. Okay. Also, they say that the unit is a self-contained general population. Therefore, that means if you have to go to the hospital for something, you do not go to the hospital and mingle with the regular population guys. You have to go to the hospital by yourself. The education department, which is one room, and the only thing they had was like adult basic education and English as a second language. Those were the only two programs that were there when I first went there. In fact, when I first went there, by me being a old law BC code inmate, I was entitled to good time earnings. Therefore, they had to have a job for me in order for me to earn my good time credits. And it simply was no jobs there. So they had to create a job for me on paper so that I would have something that they could justify giving me my good time credits. And that job consisted of walking around with a broom knocking cobwebs down off of the top of the ceiling.
Brother Abdul, we're going to take a brief break now. When we come back, we want to talk about who's in this prison. What is it about the people who are in this prison that would lead or contribute to the government's treatment and actual creation of the communications management unit. Back in a moment.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Are you tired of too many reruns on your Uhuru Radio? Want more live shows and fresh music? We do too. And we need your help. Uhuru Radio is upgrading. To serve you better, we are getting new broadcast software and new equipment for new and better programming. We need to raise $1,000 this month to make that change. So go to the Uhuru Radio donate link now and contribute whatever you can. No donation is too large or too small. Uhuru Radio is your media. We need your support. Donate today.
Hey, yo, San Diego!
Marcus Callender.
When we say self-determination, we're talking about black power. We're talking about power over our own lives
and in our own hands. And that's what real freedom means.
November 27th at the World Peace Center.
7 to 9 p.m.
The same money that's going to police and whatnot need to be in the possession of the African community so that we have not only schools, but schools that function under the control of the African community, because the struggle that we are involved in is one for power in our own hands.
President of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, in PEDUM.
But we also know that resistance in isolation and as an individual, that's not going to cut it. We know that the only real way that we're going to win our power in our own hands is through building real organizational capacity.
No more standing on the sidelines. It's time to get in the game.
What are you going to do about
the lack of economic development in our community?
The miseducation of our school children.
Did you know that
every 36 hours an African is killed by the police in the U.S.?
Your iPhone, iPad, laptop, airplane, all of it is a direct result of theft, murder, and slavery in Africa today.
Come join Diop as he puts forth a strategic plan to deal with our objective reality. November 27th at the World Peace Center.
7 to 9 p.m.
For more info, 619-500-4298. Or visit npedumresistance.wordpress.com. The Uhuru Movement.
Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
But we understand more than anything that the resistance has got to be organized.
I'm Alicia Teller. You're listening to Africa Live. And we're on the phone now with Brother Abdul Ali, who is talking to us from Washington, D.C. He is relatively recently released from a so-called communications management unit, sort of secret prison within the prison system, the federal prison system, that clearly is being exposed through this discussion as another form of concentration camp to which Africans, Muslims, and other people are subjected in this country. Brother Abdul, again, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing this information with our listeners. Could you continue and just talk a little bit more about the actual communications management unit itself, the conditions there, what it is that people are faced with in this prison system?
Okay, one of the things that I would like to point out to you is that once you get transferred into the communication management unit, you definitely want to know how you can get out of there. Okay, myself, I have several inmate grievance forms that I have filled out concerning my transfer out. In one of those grievance forms that I had filed, I asked, what were the rules? How do I go about getting out of the communications management unit now that I'm here? And I was told by Ms. Fortune, who was the acting unit manager, case manager.
Ms. Fortune?
Yes.
That's an appropriate name, but go ahead.
I was informed by her that the rules for the communication management unit were not made available to inmates. That all you can do is just basically stay there and be good, and you can get out. So my question to her was, how do I know what is good if I don't know the rules? And again, even on paper, I have it in writing where they say that we don't have a right to know the rules. And this is a serious problem, because we have one guy there who was part of the case, brother by the name of Jay Usi, and they told him that
part of what case, Brother Abdul?
Part of the case of Arif versus Holder that has been filed against Eric Holder and the Bureau of Prisons pertaining to the establishment and the violations of our rights there.
And Eric Holder is, of course, Barack Obama's head of the Justice Department.
Okay, but he's not listed as one of the plaintiffs.
Who is
one of the defendants? Barack Obama.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that Holder is his guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so
they told him that he would never get out of the communication management unit, that he would be there for the duration of his time. Now, one of the things that I would like to talk about, some of the guys.
And what was this brother's name again?
It's Kiefer Jalusi.
Kiefer Jalusi.
Jalusi.
Okay.
All right. Now, we have another guy there by the name of Clive Small. His name is Zaytoon. 76-year-old man from Trinidad. I won't go into the case that put him in there, but I will talk about some of the things that happened to him there. Okay, he's a diabetic. And for 3 days straight, he didn't get his medication. And, you know, that's dangerous for a diabetic. I seen his hands and feet swell up to the point that we thought they were going to bust. There is also, we had a brother there by the name of Saifullah Chapman, who went into a diabetic seizure because he didn't get his medication. And during the course of that seizure one night, he busted his head on the wall, you know, and they wanted to run in there and whip him because they thought that he was in there playing games, and he's standing there with his head bleeding and he's having a seizure. He's not responding to them, so they called in what's known as the goon squad. These are the people that come in and manhandle you when you don't follow the rules. And the only thing that stopped them from jumping on that brother is that one of the brothers hollered out, "We know where you live. You better not bother him." So they wouldn't run in there and whip him. And soon as the medical staff came over and seen it was him, they automatically went and got his medication and gave him a shot and brought him around. But the regular staff, they wanted to whip him because they thought that he was playing games with them. Also, we have another guy there from D.C. His name is Brian Carr, Muslim named Issa. This guy, he was like me. I had a regular street murder. That's all I had. And he was a bank robber, and they classified him as a terrorist behind the fact that he always would run his mouth and write the staff up, according to them. And we have another brother there, a good man, and his name is Rex, Christian brother. They took everything that he had in his cell, all his legal papers, all his written papers, everything, and just left the man in the cell with nothing but his clothes. In fact, they even took his mattress, saying that they needed to check it for contraband, and they left the man in the cell in that condition for at least 2 days. Only thing he had was the clothes that he had on his back. They took his soap, his tooth, they took everything he had and left him in the cell. In fact, he's married to another sister, and they won't even let him have any communications with her at all. And every time this brother gets anything in his inmate account past $25, they confiscate it, saying that he owes them a fine, and they take his money. And, well, you know, this is just a part of what's going on there. And let's say, for example, you know what disciplinary report is. A disciplinary report is something that they write up on you for breaking the prison rules. Now, you would think that by this being a terrorist unit, that we would have some serious disciplinary reports written in there. For example, I've seen disciplinary reports written on, if three men be in the cell praying together, they'll write a disciplinary report on them, saying that they're engaged in an illegal group demonstration. I've also, you've heard of the guy, the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, right?
Yeah.
They wrote this man up because he was making the call for prayer, and they also told him that he couldn't wear his pants rolled up high. They wanted to lock him up because he had his pants rolled up. said that those are gang signs, that those are things that gang members do. It's the food. Let's talk about the food in that unit. The food in that unit is prepared outside of the unit and transferred into the unit three times a day. And it's always short. It's never really enough to go around. So what that does is that begins to create hostility between the guys that serve the food and the guys that they're feeding. Because when it's time to eat, I don't want you telling me that I have to take a little bit because you have to make sure everybody else gets some when it's not even enough that you're putting on my tray to sustain me. So they breed hostility in there among the inmates there. Also, the nationality of some of the guys that were there, or some of the people that were there, we had one Aryan Brotherhood guy that I know was there. We had one Native American guy that I know that was there. We had, it was at least about five or six, let's say nine Spanish guys.
When you say Spanish, you mean Spanish-speaking. You don't mean
Spanish-speaking.
You mean from Spain?
No, not from Spain.
Okay.
From like, South America.
Yeah, Spanish-speaking.
Spanish-speaking people. Some of the guys that were allegedly part of the drug cartels. They also had the guy there that supposed to have been the mail bomber.
The mail bomber? Christian.
Yeah, the guy Christian that supposed to have been the mail bomber.
Yes.
He was there. And you had quite a few other guys there that were, some of them were actually convicted of terrorist crimes. But the mere fact that you were convicted of a terrorist crime don't mean that you get punished for committing that crime. The mere fact that you were in prison is the punishment.
Right.
So these are just some of the things that are actually going on within that unit. And to live there and to just talk about it is a whole different ball game. You know what I mean? I still remember some of the horrors of that unit, even out here in free society.
What impact have you been able to notice or know about? Does the CMU, in particular, this unit, what impact does it seem to have on families?
Okay, well, let's say, for example, let's look at the phone. If you can only make a phone call, when I first went there, between the hours of 8 o'clock and 3 o'clock, right? Okay, most of our families are working families. That means if I get a phone call, and I get one phone call a week, and that phone call is for Wednesday at 10 o'clock, and I call home Wednesday at 10 o'clock, someone is going to have to take off work, or they're going to have to keep the children out of school. Because, you know, children have to go to school. People have to work. So if I can only get a phone call between 8 and 3, then someone is going to have to stay home to get that call. Also, a 15-minute phone call, one per week. And let's just say that I have three children, a wife, and my mother is there that want to speak to me on the phone. How much time do I designate to each one of them on that phone? Or let's go in the visiting room. We have a visit behind a 2-inch plate glass window in a little room that's probably no bigger than, let's say, 5 feet by 7 feet. The one there, Trey Hutt, it had no air conditioning ventilating system there. So if I would get a visit during the summertime, I would have to take my fan up in the visiting room for me, and I would have to borrow a fan from another one of the inmates and take his fan in the visiting area for my family member. And you have one receiver in there. You have to talk on the receiver, like a regular telephone receiver. If you don't talk on that telephone receiver where they can monitor what's being said, they'll terminate your visit. So now I have my three children there, I have my wife there, and I have my mother there. How much time do I designate for each one of them on that receiver? Because more than one person can't talk on it at the same time. Now, we have one four-hour visit a month, or either two-hour visits per month. What kind of relationship am I going to develop with my children? One, let's say one is 10, one is 5, and let's say the other one is 16. What kind of relationship can a father develop with those children? How am I going to really communicate and make a serious expression of love to my children if I can't touch them? And let's say that I have a 5-year sentence to do, and I'm going to be there in that CMU for 5 years. So what kind of relationship can I develop with them? And this is one thing that I think that is really important, and I need to share this with you. On the day that I went, well, let's say the week before I left this communication management unit, going to the halfway house, I posed the question to them that if by some strange chance that I violated my parole and I was reincarcerated, would I come back to the CMU unit after being released from that unit to free society? And I was told, yes, I would, because that's what I am designated. I am designated as a high-security inmate with a terrorist, international terrorist classification, and that I would go back to the CMU unit. Now, this is something that actually happened to me since I have been out here in the street, what's known as free society. Sometime last year, I bought a little car so I could get around. And, you know, they give you paper tags. So I had one tag on the back of the car, and I had one of the paper tags laying on the front, up on the dashboard. An officer pulled me over one night, and he was very nice. He said, I'm pulling you over because you have one tag on the car, and D.C. law requires you to have two. So he said, I need your driver's license, registration, insurance, and all that. So now he's standing there talking to me very nice and cordial, and he goes and runs my name, and when he comes back, he has a different attitude. The guy is right-handed, and his gun is on the right side, so when he comes back to talk to me, he has my information in his left hand, and he's pivoted up on his right foot, with his hand not very far from his gun. So I know what happened. He went back there. He ran my name. He seen that international terrorist classification / terrorist, and he came back to me with a different attitude. However, he just issued me a warning and told me I had to put the tag on the car. But nevertheless, if I would have made a wrong move, he would have blew my brains out because of that false classification. So that communication management unit, the information that they hold on you is shared with outside law enforcement. And if that's the case, then we definitely need some type of due process before guys can be placed in that unit and given that type of a classification. Now, I haven't had to go down and get a police clearance yet, but what happens if I go down and get a police clearance for new employment, and on there they have international terrorist associate / terrorist? How am I going to be able to get a job with that? Right now, when I was transferred back from Cherry Hill, Indiana to Washington, D.C., I requested the flyback, and they said, no, communication management unit inmates can't fly. We have to take the bus. So I said, well, let me take the train. I'm going to hurry up and get home. They said, no, you have to take the bus. So I had to ride on a bus all the way from Indiana back to D.C. When I offered to pay for my own airplane ticket, and now the only way I can find out if they have put me on the no-fly list is that I have to buy a ticket, go around, and actually try to board an airplane and be turned around, all right? But now, what happens when the parole commission says we didn't give you permission to make no air travel? It's a violation of my parole to even try to find out if I'm on the no-fly list.
Well, I think this has been an incredible discussion up to now, Brother Abdul. I think it's been really informative because most people don't even know that the Communications Management Unit exists in this country, don't even have an idea that even beyond the ordinary kind of treatment, horrible treatment that Africans and other people suffer in these concentration camps called prisons, that this kind of treatment that you're describing within the CMUs exists. Most people don't have an idea, or if they do have an idea, because I got a hunch that when you look at our community anyway, the just the huge percentage of people who go through the prison system on an annual basis, most of us have relatives, friends, et cetera, who've been through that. So we have some idea, but we do this mostly, we have these experiences as individuals. We don't understand collectively what is happening to us. In the same way, when Rodney King was beaten so badly, everybody knew that it happened, but it happens in my neighborhood, and I'm the only one who sees it or knows about it. But for it to happen in the whole international community is aware of it, made a big difference. And I think that's the kind of thing that this kind of discussion that we're having with you contributes to, collectivizing this experience so that it's not just the experience of a few people and your families and your friends, but also the entire international community can be aware of it, and especially those people who have to defend themselves from what is most often referred to or commonly referred to as American democracy, usually introduced to them at the point of a gun or as a consequence of a drone missile strike. And I think it's very important that you share this with us. I want to thank you very much for the time, and I'm hoping that we can have an opportunity to talk some more, because obviously from the discussion we've had now, this is something we could be talking about for hours and hours, and people would still have an opportunity to benefit from the discussion. So I would like to offer you just 5 or 10 seconds, if there's anything else that you wanted to say very briefly before we end this segment of the program.
Okay, it's one last thing that I'd like to share with the general public, is that what you have to bear in mind is that if you are inside confinement, that you can be snatched up and placed inside the Communication Management Unit. You do not necessarily have to be inside the Federal Bureau of Prisons. What happens one day, and we hope that this never happens, you end up inside a police precinct lockup. Let's say for drunk and disorderly, they lock you up. If you're inside that police precinct, you can be taken from that police precinct to the Communication Management Unit without due process, because it's not punitive within itself. The only criteria is that you're in some form of confinement or you have been found guilty. If you had, say the judge gave you 10 days for drunk and disorderly, and you're serving that drunk and disorderly charge in your county jail, you can be taken to the Communication Management Unit.
Well,
the only criteria is that you be in some form of confinement to go to that place.
Well, that's a profound statement about the state of American democracy, and of course it's something that Africans have, in one way or another, had to experience since our being brought to this country in chains. I want to thank you again, Brother Abdul, for being with us, and I want to just let our listeners know that this is the kind of issue that the Black is Back Coalition mobilization that we just had on November 3rd and 4th in Washington, D.C., was designed to bring to the surface, and also people who are interested in engaging in the battle to overturn this kind of relationship should participate in NPDOMS, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement 21st National Convention, that's going to be held March 23rd and 24th. in St. Petersburg, Florida. Brothers and sisters, Brother Abdul, I cannot thank you enough. I thank you for your courage. I thank you for your endurance. I thank you for the fact that despite everything that you've gone through, that you're still in the trenches trying to raise your voice, trying to engage in creating a different and better kind of world for all of us. Thank you so much, my brother. And Uhuru, brothers and sisters, we'll talk to you again next Sunday, again on Africa Live.
Trapped in a snake by the